You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again. You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Hello and welcome to A Million Other Choices. If this is the first time that you are joining me, thank you for coming. Please make yourself comfortable as I talk about some harsh truths and reality of violent crime. You may have noticed that sources are not listed, mostly because it feels like homework to do a bibliography, but also because everything I say is paraphrased from publicly available sources. If you would like a list of episode-specific sources, or you want to know how the heck I know something, I am happy to send you a list. Just email me at amillionotherchoices@outlook.com, and I will do the homework and send you a bibliography. I might even do it in APA format if I'm feeling particularly ambitious. But don't count on it. And for those of you that are returning listeners, hello, it's good to see you again. Thank you for coming back. But I'm socially awkward and not good with small talk, so let's just get down to business. Morning hours of September 1st, 1994, at 3 a.m., a patrol officer in Vaughan, Ontario, about an hour's drive north of Toronto, is doing his thing and spots what he initially thinks is a tire fire at the back of a building in the city's industrial area. He assumes it's a tire fire because it was a rather intense burn, with the flames extending about 8 feet in the air from within a dumpster, where there shouldn't be any kind of fire at all. He stops the car and gets out and uses his fire extinguisher to put the flames out. When the flames are out, the officer is horrified to discover that it wasn't a tire at all, but a suitcase that had been thrown into the dumpster and then lit on fire. Inside the charred suitcase were the burnt remains of a teenage girl about 5'2". It was also evident that the girl was terribly malnourished and skinny, weighing what they estimated to be about 50 pounds. Remember, I said teenage girl, 50 pounds. I haven't weighed 50 pounds since I was about 8 years old. She also had 21 recent broken bones. There was nothing to identify the girl's remains, and an autopsy was done by Dr. Chasen. He noted that about 10% of the girl's body had been consumed by the fire, and based on the bones, she was estimated to be about 17 years old. But her BMI was only 9. A normal BMI for a teenage girl is about 18 to 25. He described her remains as having stick figure limbs. He concluded that the girl had likely been dead before she was set on fire, but could not conclusively determine a cause of death. But starvation was a pretty reasonable assumption. Police held a press conference displaying some of her unburned clothing and a sketch of what they believed she had maybe looked like in life. There were no missing persons reports for a young girl or a woman matching her description, and her identity was a mystery. A year later, they held a second press conference for information on her identity after having a cast or like a mold made from her skull. But still no one came forward with information about who the young girl was and how she had wound up starved to death and in a burning suitcase. This is the murder of Melanie Bittersing.
Believe me, if I started murdering people, there'd be none of you left.
We are all evil in some form or another.
I'm not guilty. Does that include the time I stole a comic book when I was 5 years old?
Like, let the quote stand for itself.
Far away from the landlocked province of Alberta that I call home is a small island country on the Caribbean Sea known as Jamaica. And when we close our eyes and think of Jamaica, we likely picture amazing, beautiful beaches, mojitos, and soulful swaying reggae music. But actually, living in Jamaica is not that easy. Most of the residents live in poverty, and I'm not a politician or a historian, so I'm not going to get into why that is. But it sounds like a couple of political parties spent so much time over the years fighting with each other that no one was watching the economy, or something a bunch more smarter sounding than that. And in this beautiful but poor and troubled nation, in 1990 lived a lovely Jamaican woman named Opal Austin, along with her 5 kids, Melanie, 13, Dwayne, 12, and a couple of other siblings of various ages, living in Kingston. Life in Jamaica was hard, but as a single mother, it was even harder. Their house, which would be a stretch to call it that, was more of a shack with broken wood planks, dirt floors, and a patchwork roof that leaked when it rained. They also had no running water. Opal made a living selling coconuts to tourists, and living close by in similar impoverished conditions was Beverly Scott, who lived with her 17-year-old son, Cleon, who was Melanie and Dwayne's half-brother. All kids had been fathered by Everton Bittersing, who had been born in Jamaica but had emigrated to Canada a number of years before that. Everton had a few other kids as well, some in Canada and some in Jamaica. Melanie had been born August 5, 1977. She was a quiet girl that, according to Opal, loved to read and draw and helped her mom take care of her younger siblings. She also helped with the chores. She was doing well in school and hoped one day to become a nurse, although attending higher education would have been challenging in their financial situation. Melanie had gumption and a good work ethic that would make her, like any of her ambitions, a reality. Dwayne was about 2 years younger than Melanie and loved to sing and was always a bit of a jokester. And he had that typical 12-year-old energy. In 1990, Everton came home to Jamaica for a visit, bringing with him his wife, Elaine. Elaine Bittersing was born in Jamaica and had come to Canada when she was 13 in 1974. But she had become pregnant a year later at only 14. She attempted to go back to school, but dropped out at 15 to raise her baby on her own. And when she was 18, she met Everton Bittersing, and the couple had married. Now, probably at first that Everton could immigrate to Canada, but they had stayed married, and they had 3 children together. Ken Roy, who was born in 1985, O'Neill in 1986, and then Charmaine in 1991. And before marrying Elaine, Everton Bittersing also had 2 children with Opal, Melanie and Dwayne, and then a son with Beverly Scott, who was named Cleon. Beverly was also still living in Jamaica with Cleon. He also had another daughter born in 1991, the same year that Charmaine was born, with a woman named Yvonne Hamilton, Sue Ann. Now, Sue Ann was born and raised in Toronto. Now, that's a lot. So the only names that we really need to keep in mind right now are Elaine, Everton, Melanie, Cleon, and Dwayne, at least for the time being. While in Kingston visiting, Everton came to visit both Opal and his kids, Melanie and Dwayne, and then also visited Beverly and Cleon. And he proposed to both Opal and Beverly that if they allowed it, all 3 of the kids would have a better future and lives if they returned to Canada to live with them. They could go to school, get a really good education, and just basically better opportunities. So although horribly sad to see their children go, both Opal and Beverly knew that this was really the best hope for them having a better life and for Melanie to achieve her goals. And so on January 25th, 1991, Melanie and her brothers boarded a flight destined for Canada. It was Toronto, to be specific. Melanie was 13, Dwayne was 12, and Cleon was 17. But remember, Elaine already had two children of her own at that time. There was Kenroy O'Neill and then Charmaine, who was born 9 months later. So when they returned to Toronto, there was now seven people living in their one-bedroom apartment, and which, of course, became eight when Charmaine was born. But it was still an oasis compared to their living conditions in Kingston. And after their children left, Opal would call collect from a payphone down the street from her home. And over the next year, she only got to talk to the kids twice. Every other time, Everton always said that they were either busy or they were at school. And after a year of that, he stopped accepting her calls completely, saying that they were too expensive. So Opal didn't know how her children were doing in their new lives, but was hopeful that they were living well and fulfilling their dreams. Only on June 15th, 1992, only 18 months after they had come to Canada, Everton sent word to Opal that Dwayne, who had just turned 14, had died. Everton told her that he had threatened to send him back to Jamaica for misbehaving, and Dwayne had become distraught at that and scared, so he had jumped from the 22nd floor balcony of their apartment. So Opal, of course, was distraught and wanted Melanie back home with her, even if it meant that she couldn't really afford to give her the education and the life that she wanted so badly. And she reached out to the Minister of Affairs asking for help in getting Melanie back. And she received a letter from them telling her that they had spoken with Everton, who had said that Melanie was happy where she was and was in school and she was feeling quite happy despite the death of her brother. Well, Opal didn't know what to do or where to turn. And after that, the number that she had for Everton was out of service because Everton, Elaine, and the kids had actually moved apartments and were no longer in any contact with Opal. Now, sometime in the late 1990s, Elaine and Everton once again returned to Jamaica, this time to live. But Melanie wasn't with them, and Opal implored Everton to tell her where Melanie was, and he had just said that she had run away to live in America somewhere. Now, seeing by this time Melanie was an adult, there really wasn't anything for Opal to do if Melanie didn't want to reach out herself. So Opal did what I find both heartbreaking and heartwarming. She was working at that coconut stand and she would pull out the picture that she had of Melanie and ask any American tourists if they knew her or had seen her. And no one ever said that they had. By 2011, Elaine and Everton had returned to Canada to St. Catharines, which is still in Ontario, where they religiously, no pun intended, attended church services each Sunday at the Bible Way Church. Now, the pastor remembers Elaine in particular because she was a very gregarious and dramatic worshiper, one of those ameners and hallelujahs. And they often both used the church's charity funds for like food and clothing. And so they would often mill about after the services. And after one particular service in late November of 2011, Elaine asked to speak with the pastor away from Everton. Elaine told the pastor about a girl that Everton had living with them that had died, probably because he refused to feed her. And he kept her in this closet, and if she tried to feed him, or if she tried to feed the girl, he would beat her. Elaine asked the pastor for forgiveness, and he granted it, much to her relief. Now, the story didn't make a lot of sense to the pastor, who tried Googling missing girls or something about a girl starving, and he came up with nothing. But as unbelievable as Elaine's story was, and as prone to dramatics as she was, something about the story needled at him. So on November 28th, 2011, he called the police and left a message about a possible homicide. That message was picked up by Constable Detective Stephen Ryan. Stephen immediately didn't make the connection to the unidentified remains that were found in 1994, but decided to follow up on the tip by sitting down with Elaine. And Elaine told them that Melanie had come to live with them from Jamaica, and that Everton had beat Elaine quite regularly, and that both her and Melanie were afraid of him. However, she didn't come off as all that victim-y. like a victim of abuse, as you would expect.
Everton used to beat me a lot, okay? That's where I started to get accustomed to being afraid. There are many occasions I tried to get away from Everton, like divorce-wise, and it just wouldn't work.
She said she had no idea how Melanie had died, but that she had been there when it happened and that she thought her death was probably because Everton refused to feed her.
Was Melanie afraid of her father?
Yes, she was afraid. Yes, she was.
You went, sorry?
Tom, you told her a few times, too.
Did you see Melanie in the closet when she died?
Yeah. I did.
What does her body look like? The state of her body?
She was thin. Maybe she wasn't getting enough food.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again. You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
And if Elaine tried to feed her, of course, he would beat her. So once she was dead, it was Elaine that had admitted that it was her idea to put her in a suitcase, but that Everton and Cleon were the ones that had taken the suitcase and then, of course, Melanie's remains in them away. Now, she also made sure to ask Stephen to make sure that she wasn't charged with anything.
I don't want to be charged with nothing, okay?
Stephen said he couldn't promise her that. He had a little bit more investigation to do, and so he let her go. The race, the age, and the circumstances of Melanie's death sounded eerily familiar to Stephen, who had only recently started on the force when the remains in the suitcase had been found. He had Dr. Grusperer from the Center of Forensic Sciences to try to identify the remains again to do a second autopsy on her. Her skeleton had been preserved. Her remains were later identified as Melanie Bittersing, likely by DNA that was taken from Everton. However, the autopsy found a few surprising things. First of all, Melanie had these 21 recent fractures to her spine, her ribs, her pelvic bone, her kneecaps, and her ankles. And the fractures were all showing signs of healing, which indicated that they had occurred between 3 weeks and 6 months prior to her death. Dr. Grusperer wrote in his report that her injuries would have been not only excruciating, but also would have rendered her immobile. Dr. Grusperer also noted from the first autopsy that there was this frothy fluid in her bronchial tubes, identified as diatom, or basically a single-cell aquatic plant that comes from like lakes or streams, that Melanie had inhaled water before she died. In fact, Dr. Grusperer and Dr. Chasen, who had reviewed his findings, determined that drowning had been Melanie's actual cause of death. So 21 broken bones and being malnourished to the point of a BMI of 9 wasn't quite enough, but she had been drowned to top off her unbelievable misery that she had lived. Well, taking this information back to both Everton and Elaine didn't go over so well. They just kind of blamed each other and Cleon for all of it, and no one claimed to know anything about nothing.
You could be charged with murder, depending on what we learn, okay?
For what? I mean,
did you kill your daughter?
No way.
Did you ever hit her? Mm-mm. Who killed her?
I really don't.
Who killed her? It wasn't you who killed her.
I made a mistake.
Tell me about your mistake.
The mistake is to bring them from Jamaica.
Officer, get your information good, sir. Because God is watching you to do a good job.
I'm trying. Elaine, the charges you're facing right now are horrendous. They're very serious.
Yeah, I understand that, but guess what? There is a God who is bigger than all those charges, okay? Because God knows I didn't do anybody anything, so I don't know anything. Excuse me?
Melanie had very bad injuries.
What do you mean by Melanie had very bad injuries? I don't understand you.
What don't you understand?
No, honest to God, what do you mean she had bad injuries?
The worst injuries that I've ever seen on one person in all my years of doing detective work. The worst.
No! Oh my God, I thought it was just a food. Jesus Christ, no.
Melanie's body was left in an abandoned area and set ablaze. In a suitcase that you suggested they put her body in. You did that. You made that suggestion. I need to know why.
Stephen Ryan had told CBC, once she said, I didn't know anything, I knew in my mind 21 broken bones that were healing, that were never seen by a doctor, never reported, and the doctors told me before that interview that Melanie would have been in such excruciating pain and she could not move. She would have been basically immobile because her pelvis was broken, her legs were broken, her ankle was broken, and her vertebrae was broken. So when Elaine says to me, I didn't know this was going on, you got to call BS on that one. I actually went outside of 52 Division, that's where those interviews were done, and I stood on the corner of Dundas and University, and I found myself almost gasping for breath for about 15 minutes, because I could not believe I just came face to face with those two who I consider monsters. So on March 2nd, 2012, arrest warrants were issued for Elaine, Everton, and Cleon, who were each charged with failure to provide the necessaries of life, criminal negligence causing bodily harm, aggravated assault, forcible confinement, and indignity to a human dead body. Now, murder wasn't actually a charge yet because they needed a bit more information about what had happened and who did what. Everton and Elaine were living in Welland at the time. Cleon, who's Melanie's half-brother, was living in Calgary, and he was picked up there. Now, Cleon was later released and testified against his father and Elaine, pushing most of the blame onto Elaine. Now, he was later released after giving his story, but suspicion over his involvement kind of endured. He has never been officially charged with anything, and it sounds like living in this house was hell on earth. So I actually don't have any reason to doubt his account. I think that it was kind of, you know, do what he was told or die. Now, Elaine sang a little bit more than Everton did. Everton maintained that nothing happened. According to Elaine's version of events, in 1991, the family was living on Close Avenue in Toronto with Melanie, Duane, and Cleon. And from the get-go, Everton had rationed their food and never enrolled any of them in school, despite that being the main reason they had come to Canada. In 1992, Duane had taken a part-time job delivering papers, but this one night he hadn't come home. He had instead stayed at a friend's house, telling his friends that when they, meaning Everton and Cleon, would come looking for him, that they were going to kill him. But Everton had managed to track him down, and on the ride home, had told Duane how they were going to beat him. So when they got home, Everton and Cleon had actually moved the furniture in the living room to create basically a fight ring. Elaine, of course, was told to go into the bedroom, shut the door, and to not come out no matter what. And while they were kind of in the bedroom with her, explaining to her what they were going to be doing, that they were going to be beating him, they heard a scream, and Duane had jumped from the balcony to avoid this punishment. Now, as for Melanie, she was forced to live in a closet during 1994, and Everton came to her and told her that she had stiffened up, like she was dead. And Cleon and Everton packed her tiny emaciated remains into the suitcase and told Elaine that she was coming with them for a ride, where they all drove together to this industrial area in Vaughan and dumped the suitcase. Cleon had not had contact with either Everton or Elaine since he had moved to Calgary after Melanie's death. So Everton and Elaine had their trials held separately. Murder was added to both of their charges, and I can't really talk that much about Everton's trial, but it was pretty similar to how Elaine's had gone. Although Elaine was prone to emotional outbursts and bits of cussing. And both of their fates came down mostly to the testimony of Cleon. Now, remember, Cleon had originally been charged as culpable himself, but was released, likely in exchange for his testimony. So the justice did caution the jury that his testimony, although uncontested, should be taken with a grain of salt. Only he said it in more legal terms than that. However, his testimony does align with the evidence that they had, so I'm going to add a few additional grains of salt to his pile and take it as more honest than not honest. There is possibly some deflection here, and I think, but I think he was mostly truthful. So as the story goes, according to Cleon, when they arrived in Toronto, they were met at the airport by Elaine and Everton, where they drove them to Parkdale to this 22nd floor one-bedroom apartment, which was a luxury to the three kids compared to where they had come from. Cleon said that the abuse had started pretty much right away towards himself, but then expanded over time to Dwayne and Melanie. None of Elaine's children were ever abused, but none of the kids ever attended school, like including hers. Melanie, over time, would endure the worst of the abuse, and Cleon never understood why she was singled out. It seems as though Everton and Elaine really just didn't care about his kids at all, and was just downright hostile towards the kids that he said that he was going to give them a better life to. Cleon's assessment was that Everton was just a mean bastard and was violent in general. And Elaine was a bit of a different cookie. Her religious obsession seemed to make her think that the kids born from Jamaica were somehow dirty and possessed by the devil. And she also wasn't thrilled with the concept of feeding three people that weren't biologically hers. She didn't like the idea of supporting someone else's children. Cleon testified that at no point that they were in Canada were they ever attempted to be enrolled in school, like not even homeschooling. In the summer of 1992, Melanie was taken to a doctor for something or other, but that was the only medical treatment or seeing of any kind of medical professional that she had ever gotten. In fact, Melanie was not allowed outside of the apartment at all, like ever, for any reason ever. One time she did try to escape, which I'm going to get to a little bit later. This story, I think, is better told by Detective Steve Ryan. So basically, no one in Canada, other than in the Bittersing household, knew that Melanie even existed. So there was no need for any kind of missing persons report, and no one would have ever known to look for her or to even check in on her, other than Opal, who was miles away and had no way to contact them. And he was just feeding her more lies anyways. Melanie, getting the worst of the abuse, was forced to sleep on the floor on a piece of cardboard. And the floor was, of course, hardwood. She was often not allowed to eat anything at all. Cleon, Dwayne, and Melanie were all forced to use separate dishes from the rest of the family and told that they were dirty and had germs. They were all pretty much treated as like house slaves. They didn't own a vacuum, so they were forced to pick up little tiny specks of dirt from the floor with their hands. Cleon had to do all of the cooking for the family, except for Melanie, of course, who was mostly not allowed to eat anything. And when Charmaine was born, Elaine retreated to her bedroom, like the one and only bedroom that they had, that only the Canadian-born children and her and Everton were allowed to sleep in. And she would watch this religious programming for the entire day. So Charmaine became Melanie's responsibility to care for. And as punishment for any of Melanie's perceived transgressions, she was dragged to the bathroom by Everton, by the hair, I will add, and her head was flushed in the toilet. But they weren't allowed to actually use the bathroom for regular bathrooming things. Instead, they had to rig up their own curtain on the balcony and were given a bucket filled with cold water to do their showering with. And due to the malnutrition and probably recurring urinary tract infections that Melanie had, her urine had a strong smell, or at least what Elaine perceived as a strong smell. So she had made her use a bucket out on the balcony for that. Melanie was also punished by being locked on the balcony or put in a barrel or used to sit in a squat position inside the broom closet. Now, after her escape attempt, which again I'm going to get to, she was handcuffed to a chain that was put on her ankle and then attached to a wall. And the nightly routine was that Everton would beat her before going to bed and then attach her with the handcuffs and then remove them in the morning so that she could basically resume her chores and taking care of Charmaine. When Everton would beat Melanie, which was daily, he would punch her, kick her, and stomp on her. And according to Cleon, all of the beatings were done by Everton, except for three times that he remembers where it was Elaine inflicting the abuse. Now, one time Elaine spat on her, and another time she smashed her upside the head with a coffee cup, which broke. Elaine had said that she had brought a curse with her from Jamaica and that Melanie was Satan himself. And another time she grabbed Melanie by the head and told her, "I'm going to take the devil out of you. I know how to take the devil out of you," and would start loudly wailing and praying. Although Elaine didn't partake in the physical abuse nearly as often or as badly as Everton did, she still did nothing about it, and the verbal rants against Melanie were a constant. Elaine was also an instigator, telling Everton all of Melanie's faults and problems, knowing that it would get her beatings and other punishments. With regards to Elaine, because I have only really court documents on her trial, the basis of both the prosecution and the defense regarding her was that Cleon testified that he never actually heard Elaine tell Everton to beat Melanie or punish her. And she didn't like supervise or watch the beatings. She spent most of her time in the bedroom, but there was a lot of closed door meetings between Elaine and Everton. And Cleon believes that Elaine was in fact sort of leading the charge, as it were. Both apartments that they had lived in while they were in Canada were very small, so it was impossible not to know what was going on. And a lot of times, beatings would go down by Elaine would come out of the room, she would complain about something that Melanie did or didn't do, calling her the devil, and then go back into the room and shout at Everton, like, about her. Like, nobody worked or went to school in this house, so everyone was always home. Then, of course, Everton would come out of the room and start beating on Melanie. Cleon said that Elaine was the mind behind the beatings and that Everton was the fist. At Elaine's trial, she claimed that she herself lived in fear of Everton and his beatings, and she was helpless to do anything for Melanie. And there was evidence that Elaine had been subjected to Everton's ill temper on more than one occasion. She sometimes would have a black eye or like a swollen lip after hearing them argue. But this happened far less frequently than it did to Melanie, and to a much lesser extent. Now, do not get me wrong, putting your hands on a woman in anger is, like, no matter what the outcome, is wrong. But it isn't comparable to what Melanie, a child, endured. And Elaine herself was described as a very angry and controlling woman. Yvonne Hamilton also testified at Elaine's trial against her. Now, she's the mother of Sue-Ann, who was born the same year that Charmaine was born to Elaine. And she said that she saw a lot of the relationship between Elaine and Everton over the years, and said that, "I believe that Elaine had as strong a role in the relationship as Everton did. As I said, Everton didn't do anything without seeking Elaine's, like, confirmation, without getting her permission. She also testified that she never saw any injuries on Elaine over the years that she knew her. Yvonne and Everton's daughter, Suann Bittersingh, also testified. Now, she said that Elaine always accompanied Everton on his visits with her, and that Elaine was the one in control of the money. And she often saw bundles of cash in her purse, and that anytime they went out somewhere, like shopping or for food, it was Elaine that would make the decision of what they were going to buy, if anything. So it was kind of Elaine that bossed Everton around and told him what to do. She also said that one time in 1991, like this was before Charmaine was born, that Elaine had left Everton and she took Kenroy and O'Neill and Melanie as well with her to her mom's place. And Everton had faked a heart attack to get her to return, and she did at that point. Now, after Charmaine was born, Elaine only left the apartment, it seemed, to go to church services and stayed in her bedroom most of the time, like even eating her meals in there. But she was not a prisoner. She had made the choice to devote her time to her religious programs. Now, Charmaine, who's now an adult, also testified, but her testimony was largely kind of dismissed because she was only 3 when Melanie had died. But she did confirm that Everton was violent and had abused all of the children, including her. But my understanding was that only Melanie, Duane, and Cleon were abused physically. She did say that Elaine had told her that when Melanie had died, she had wanted to call the police, but that Everton had threatened to take her children away from her, like the ones that she apparently loved and cared about. But she had told the pastor at the church that she didn't call because they didn't have a phone, which was not true either. One thing that the jury never got to hear was the circumstances of Duane's death, which we are also going to get to in a little bit here. Now, so on the evening of August 31st, 1994, Cleon went to bed and he admitted that he had been like cleaning Melanie when she sometimes soiled herself, which of course would happen, and that he could see her bones, and that when he went to bed that night, she was lying on her little cardboard bed in the living room, facing towards the balcony and just kind of curled up in a fetal position. He said that she looked like someone was dying, or someone who was dying, but he didn't think that she was actually going to die. So he didn't see like the actual death of Melanie, but was awoken about 3 a.m. that she had died. And then, of course, this whole suitcase thing happened where she was taken out of the apartment and then dumped in this dumpster and then set on fire. So in both Elaine and Everton's trials, the jury had to decide Melanie's cause of death. It was either severe neglect, which like starvation, or drowning. Now, here to clarify, just let me sort of read this from the sentencing report on Elaine's trial. Based on the evidence adduced at trial, the jury was left with 2 possible causes of death. The course of severe neglect, malnutrition, and abuse to which Melanie had been subjected for close to 3 years, and drowning. The jury's verdict does not reveal whether the jury was able to come to a unanimous conclusion as to which it was. Based on the evidence of Dr. Pullen, with which Dr. Chasen agreed, I am satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt that Melanie was drowned. And based on the pattern within which the vast majority of the assaults on Melanie occurred, I am satisfied that the person who physically carried out the act of drowning was Everton. However, I have no doubt that the drowning occurred at the end of the torturous course of physical, emotional, and psychological abuse and neglect to which Melanie had been subjected. In these circumstances, whether the immediate cause of death was drowning or the lengthy course of abuse is largely beside the point. Regardless of which it was, the evidence is overwhelming that for almost all of the 3.5 years that Melanie was in the charge of Everton and Elaine, she suffered through a horror of existence that was inevitably going to kill her. Now, I would concur with that. Okay, so there's a couple more details for me to tell you about Melanie and Duane's short lives. But first, Everton was convicted of first-degree murder, and he got life, no parole, for 25 years. That was in 2016, and on March 25th, 2025, so just a couple of months ago, at 69 years old, he died at the Millhaven Institute at the hospital there from apparently natural causes. Elaine was convicted of second-degree murder.
And here at home, drama inside the courtroom during the sentencing of the Toronto woman convicted of killing her stepdaughter. Elaine Bittersingh has been sentenced to at least 16 years in prison in the death of her 17-year-old stepdaughter. CTV's Austin Delaney is at the University Avenue courthouse. Drama this morning there, Austin. Bittersingh's outburst forced the judge to shut down the hearing.
Lots of drama in courtroom 2-5. Mr. Justice Ian McDonald had just started reading the reasons for his sentencing when Elaine Bittersingh stood up in the prisoner's box and started screaming at the top of her lungs, "Jesus, Jesus, Jesus." The justice told her to settle down, to keep quiet. She said, "Why should I keep quiet? I didn't do anything to her." The "her" she's referring to, of course, is her stepdaughter, Melanie. But some of the other things that she yelled out today: "Jesus is the only judge. There is one judge. Jesus is the only judge." She looked at the arresting officer, Steve Ryan, and said, "Steve Ryan, you're an evil man." And those two bitches, looking at the two Crown attorneys, two females, those are witches. So that was what it was like in there today. She also looked at the jurors. There were four jurors who had come here to watch the sentencing. They were sitting in the body of the courthouse. She looked at them and yelled, "You were paid to convict me. You were paid to convict me." And for the rest of the time, she sat in that prisoner's box and just gave those four jurors an evil, evil glare. Of course, now she has been sentenced to life in prison without eligibility for parole for 16 years for the second-degree murder of her stepdaughter, Melanie.
Now, the judge took time to mention that Elaine had not only told Opal that her daughter had run away, which was a lie, and gave her false hope that she would one day see Melanie again, but that she said that she had run away because she was a thief who had stolen her jewelry. Basically, that was a very cruel action to take. And he added that Melanie came to Canada with hopes and dreams. Over a period of up to 3 years, the persons entrusted with her care crushed those hopes and dreams with a cruel, callous, relentless, and ultimately lethal course of physical, psychological, and emotional abuse. What happened to Melanie is inexplicably sad. When given her opportunity to speak, Elaine said, "All I want to say is Jesus knows everything, and Jesus has provided the lawyers to present the case, and so I'll just leave it at that." Opal Austin, Melanie's mom, made the trek to Canada to speak at her sentencing. I cannot imagine how she managed to do that. Like, hopefully somebody helped her pay for it. And she said, so let me just read it to you. "I am thankful for this chance to have my say today, but it is the most difficult thing I have ever had to do, to express how I am feeling into words that it fully expresses the impact of this horrific crime against my precious daughter, Melanie. There is nothing, I mean absolutely nothing, Melanie ever could have done that could have led to the dreadful outcome of her murder. So I am left wondering why for the rest of my life. Melanie was my angel, full of love and care for others. She had dreams to be a nurse and she loved to sing. Her dreams were possible to achieve because she was smart, caring, and people loved her. She loved her family and I could not have loved her more. I miss her very much when she immigrated to Canada, but I believe deep in my heart that it was for the best. As it turned out, it was for the worst. For the very person I expected to keep her safe and support her dreams turned out to be the cruelest nightmare she will never wake up from. So I am left to relive images of the nightmare she went through over and over. I no longer sleep in peace. My nerves are on edge. My body is weak and I feel sick all over. I cannot stop thinking of how much she suffered." Cleon Bittersingh, who was then 32 years old, he also gave a victim impact statement, telling the court that he still has nightmares and insecurities about his own capability as a father because of what that he had suffered and he had witnessed Melanie suffer, saying, "No human being or animal should ever be treated the way Melanie and I were treated at the hands of Everton and Elaine Bittersingh. Regardless, I have my life and I am alive, unlike my sister Melanie, who never got a chance to live her life to succeed." Knowing what I know now, I also carry extreme guilt for not stopping the abuse and the torture of Melanie and me, running away, getting help. This, again, is an internal conflict that I deal with every single day of my life, and I will never forgive myself for.
Well, she grew up with a family who tortured her, and you know, eventually she died as a result of the abuse that she had sustained. She came from another country to live with her father and her stepmother for a better life. She never went to school. She never went to a doctor. There's still nothing in place where we can check on children who come from other countries, because we cannot let this happen again. No child should die like Melanie died.
Now, I don't know what became of Elaine's other children, but I do know that Kenroy, who's the oldest of her kids, who would now be 40, I think, suffers from treatment-resistant schizophrenia and has been in and out of the hospital about 100 times over the years. Okay, so Steve Ryan remembers Melanie's case. It was kind of the case that broke him. And he spoke about the case to both W5 and CBC, the detectives, and told the story of Melanie's attempted escape that he believes was the beginning of the end for Melanie. He just can't help but feel that Melanie would have arrived in Canada excited for her future, that she would be able to go to a good school and she would make new friends, but she never got to even leave the apartment more than maybe like 5 times in the 3 years that she was here. He said that she was confined to that apartment from the time that she walked in there until, like, when she first arrived, until they took her out in a suitcase. Steve feels that Everton and Elaine had brought them to Canada not to give them this better life, but to sort of improve their lives by basically giving them, like, treating them as slave labor, and that Melanie would be then used to school her own children, because, of course, nobody went to school. And when they did the search warrant on the apartment, there were these scratch marks on the wall in the closet where Melanie was often held prisoner. He said, quote, "In one of the closets, there were scratch marks on the wall, and I imagined her doing this with her nails, trying to go through the drywall to get into the hallway. And I thought, I still think as a kid, like, who is she calling out for? Like, her mom, her dad? Like, aren't they the ones that you call out for when you're sick or when you're hurt and when you're scared? And she was, or would have been, all three of those. And mom and dad are basically the ones that are put her in the closet. So, like, who was she supposed to call for help for? Her brother couldn't help her because he would get beaten himself. So, like, their job was just to survive and kind of walk that fine line between keeping dad happy and being Melanie's buddy at the same time. Like, he was completely helpless. He couldn't help her, and it wasn't really his fault. And at some point, Melanie had made a break for it. At the time, she already would have had those 21 healing fractures and hadn't eaten in days. And so she dragged, like, literally dragged herself out of the apartment into the fire stairwell. Her pelvis was fractured in both of her legs, and she was down to like 50 pounds. Like, imagine the pain of just trying to stay conscious to do that. She got as far as the door to this fire escape and tried to kind of hide behind it. I guess just trying to figure out what she was going to do, or figure out how she was going to get down these stairs. Now, it didn't take long for Cleon to find her. So when he found her, he said to her that, you know, we can't trust the police because their dad had told them that the cops were bad people. They had no friends. They didn't have a school that they went to. So he told her, like, we got to go back to the apartment. So he brought her back into the apartment. And then she was, of course, put into these chains and then forced to live in the barrel or in the closet, and that's where she lived. And they think she probably lived there after that escape attempt for about a year, because Duane had died in 1992, and according to all of the family, the beatings got worse in 1992, and she wasn't actually murdered until 1994, so a year and a half to 2 years would have been just absolute pure hell for her. Now, as for Duane's death, which at the time had officially been ruled a suicide, Steve kind of wondered if there was more to that story as well, which I'm sure you do. So he ordered Duane's remains to be exhumed, and he actually drove out to the cemetery the night before to kind of talk to Dwayne. And he stood by Dwayne's gravesite and told him that he wanted to apologize to him, that they were going to be disturbing him.
Each boy whose questionable suicide just 2 years before his sister's charred remains were found in a suitcase in Vaughan is now the subject of a cold case homicide investigation by Toronto Police.
But that it was because he wanted to make sure that nobody had done this to him, like nobody had hurt him or killed him. And so he just kind of stood there for that time and then just... He just felt compelled to apologize to him because he thought it was, you know, it's a kind of a big deal to dig up somebody's body when they've been laid to rest and that they've been resting peacefully for about a decade at that point. So he just wanted to apologize to him. But unfortunately, Dwayne's remains only showed damage consistent with a fall from a 22-floor building. Now, Steve's ultimate theory is that Dwayne had to tried to run away. He had got caught and was terrified of another beating by his dad. So he had climbed out the balcony of their apartment and then tried to flee by like moving to another balcony and had lost his balance and fell. They can't prove that he was pushed, even though there were basically 8 people at home at the time. And of course, nobody would put it past Everton to do that. That was an awful, awful story. That was the murder of Melanie Bittersing. And it is also the kind of the end of Opal Austin's life, too. Like, I feel so sorry for her to live out her life without Melanie and Dwayne. And knowing that poverty would have been a better future than what they had endured in a country that was supposed to be the land of freedom and opportunity, I can't imagine. It's such a terrible story. And I cannot imagine somebody doing that to a 13-year-old girl for no reason and for years. Like, how you can watch somebody suffer like that and not do something, I just can't imagine. But with that, I'm going to be back again next week with another horrible awful. And in the meantime, you, by now, hopefully you know what to do with your rates, reviews, their Red Circle exclusive, Patreon exclusive, ad-free. There's merchandise on spreadshop.com. I'm on Instagram. And you can email me as well at amillionotherchoices@outlook.com. And as always, thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Please leave a review on Apple, a rate on Spotify, or a comment on the episode. To support the podcast, you can find me on buymeacoffee.com or merchandise is available on Spreadshop. You can also receive bonus and ad-free podcast episodes on either Red Circle, where you can add a link for Apple, or on Patreon, which is linkable on Spotify. Podcast episodes come out each Monday, and videos on YouTube are posted on Fridays. You can reach me at amillionotherchoices@outlook.com, where I try very hard to reply to emails in a somewhat timely manner.